offering loving pranams at Bhagwan's lotus feet. Dear listeners, we welcome you to this week's episode of Shravanam Mananam Nididhyasanam. As always, this is Prem from Team Radio Sai, and with me is Brother Harishankar from the Shri Siddha Sai Settle Trust. We yet to continue the discourse we left off a couple of weeks back. It's the 12th discourse in the series, the 1991 summer course series. We played one clip from that discourse, and this discourse is about, in general, about spiritual discipline. As if you've been following our series, you'll know that this is about the Upanishads, this entire series of discourses. We had about three discourses on the Prashna Upanishad. There was one on the Mundaka Upanishad. There were last couple of discourses were on some of the aspects of the Mandukya Upanishad. And this discourse is a very general one where Swami is speaking about sadhana and what it means. What do you expect and what do you look for when you are going through the process of sadhana? So before we discuss about what we played the last time around and before we go into the next clip which we'll be playing today, we offer a humble pranam at Bhagwan's lotus feet, and I invite Brother Hari to join all of us. Saram Hari.
Saram Prit.
Last week, I think the main thing were two poems which Swami sang at the beginning of that discourse. One was, of course, about the plight of the society, where he said the fear of sin has disappeared, wicked actions have become commonplace, and devotion to Lord Vishnu is absent. The world is becoming a den of indescribable cruel acts. Lord Vishnu is the refuge of the sages and saints, and his name alone can grant peace. That was one of the poems which Swami sang. And the other one was about mastering education and mastering learning being of no use if you do not have devotion to the Lord. And it's interesting because if you look at the second Padyam which Swami sang, I don't know how many of the people who are coming through the modern system of education can really relate to this, where Swami is equating knowledge gathering to devotion as such. And the more knowledgeable you become, the more devotion you should have. Because I think the modern education tends to take you farther away from thoughts of God and the idea of being subservient to the Supreme. It's more of, I can understand more, I can figure out more. Yeah. So, I think that pretty much comes out because of the third or fourth discourse in the series. Swami speaks about how man's reverence to God is based on the unknown. The more there were unknown things in nature, correct, he had more reverence to God. Yeah. And that is why with learning, with scientific advancement, the number of unknowns are reducing, and along with that, his reverence to God also seems to be reducing.
Exactly. So many people actually do point out that how even in the Rig Vedas, you find that many of the hymns are actually towards the forces of nature.
Right.
And it kind of mirrors that how powerless, you know, man felt against the forces of nature. So naturally many of the prayers were addressed to like keeping us, the, you know, the race or the society or the village safe from such forces.
Right.
So lot of verses are towards that, or their pleadings to the God to help them win against their enemies. So it's a kind of, it's read as a commentary on the nature of society, that time. And nobody can deny that definitely that was one of, but what we must not forget is that the Vedas or the Upanishads, etc., they cater to a large spectrum of beliefs, of psychological makeup of people. Like I think, the religion which we call Hinduism or Sanatan Dharma, you will find that it is a spectrum. It can address like any make of a person, It can cater to whatever spiritual leanings you have, which include a leaning where you don't believe in a God.
Right.
There are systems of Indian philosophy which, take away the need for a God, and all of them are equally part of the Hindu or the Indian tradition.
I always quote this Veer Savarkar, who's supposed to be spoken of as the father of the Hindu Mahasabha, the extreme right wing of Hindutva in our country. He would often describe himself as a Hindu atheist.
Yeah.
Though he was very strongly attached to Hinduism, he would always describe himself as an atheist. So, right. I mean, that came as a surprise when I read it, because here is somebody who is that extreme right wing, but he is actually not devoted to God in that sense.
Right.
And that is how, as you're saying, all encompassing the Hindu thought was.
Correct.
Sanatan Dharma was.
Yeah. Because of the same setting, you must understand that much of the Vedas, Upanishads have originated at a physical level at about the same time, right? Mm-hmm. We didn't have much control over the forces of nature at that time. And even then, these are the same Upanishads which could proclaim that this puny little man and that bright sun, such a powerful illuminating sun, which in all the rest of the Vedas, you're going on, praying that, you know, this is the God that protects all humanity and this and that. And then comes this one Upanishad where it says that that man and that sun are essentially the same.
Right.
In the Taittiriya Upanishad, in the Anandavalli, that is a proclamation. So we must look at it in the entirety that yes, there are people, even among, say, devotees of Swami, right? We look to God for so many different things. We look to God for succor from what we are presently undergoing, like trials.
Mm.
And it would be so inhuman of me to go to such a person and say, like, you know, don't pray to Swami for these small things, right? Because Swami has always been a person like who's always reached out in times of people's suffering.
Right.
It didn't matter to him, you know, spiritually elevated or whatever. But as a child, if you cried out to your mother, the Swami would respond. And it is not, you know, very correct to go to such a person and lecture saying that, you know, you should aspire for higher things from the Lord. You know, that kind of position is in fact not very advisable.
Right.
Right. So, God, for many people, yes, like, God does become a peg on which we hang our worries. Right. And for other people, they look to Swami for resolving their spiritual doubts, you know, like how do I resolve a situation like a person is constantly needling me and you tell me that I should always love that person. Swami, how do I do it?
Mm-hmm.
You know, there are people who have that, who have questions of that sort. But at the same time, like there are other people who look to God for the highest wisdom, right? They say, Swami, you show me how you and I are one, right? Or how I am Lord. Enlighten me that, show me the divinity in myself. Mm. But Swami is present for the entire spectrum.
Mm.
He is not only for the jnani, or he is not only for the bhakta. Mm. Swami caters to every single, psychological makeup of a person.
Going back to this idea of the unknown leading to reverence.
Hmm.
Many times when you look at it, you know, especially when you look at the way science goes around exploring, science can give you the methodology of how it happens. And somewhere in that detailing, we lose the idea that, you know, still there needs to be somebody who needs to orchestrate this whole thing.
Right.
And many times, if you look at in mundane things, you see the difference between, a devotee and a person who is very, very rational. You know, always the rational person tries to think, you know, where did it come from? Even miracles related to Swami, some things are, of course, absolutely beyond your imagination and your understanding. That's clearly is a miracle for everybody, right? But there are many things which happen, a devotee would easily take it as a miracle. A classic example is, you know, once I was talking to a senior of mine, and he was telling that one day he was just coming out of mandir, and it was just after aarti had got over, and that day prasadam was apples or something like that. Now he comes out and there was this elderly man, with him was a little boy. So they were inquiring, is darshan over? Has Swami gone back? You know, they had apparently come a bit late. So this person was telling him, yeah, you can come later in the evening, the morning session's over or whatever it is. Then he had this apple in his hand, and there was this little boy, so he just gave it to him. He said, you know, you take this, this is today's prasadam. And this boy takes it with his mouth wide open, right? And this boy said, you know, why are you so surprised? You know, I just got this apple, I'm giving you. And this boy said, no, last night Swami came in my dream, and Swami told me, tomorrow is your birthday, I will give you prasadam.
Oh,
okay? I mean, this is a very small thing, and if you go into the details, yeah, that day happens to be a festival, and every festival day you have prasadam
Correct.
Given,
mm-hmm.
and that prasadam was given, and you happen to meet a boy. I mean, it's there are so many obvious things in the whole process. So if you study the process, probably the, you know, the awe out of the incident might just go away. But for that child, he did not see the details. He just saw, you know, one end to the other end. Swami told me he'll give prasadam, and you know, without my making any effort, I've got prasadam.
Mm-hmm.
So many times when you look at it, science goes into the details. Like,
yeah.
probably when we did not have know the elements, we were wonderstruck by the idea that there is this bright light which comes out and it's put off after some time. Then you imagine that probably there's God who is putting on the light and putting off the light.
Mm-hmm.
But then you read the details of it. Okay, this is actually a star and this rises and the earth is rotating around it. But it still does not necessarily explain everything about it. But just the idea that we know a little more detail of how it happens surprisingly takes the awe out of the whole thing, and we start believing that everything can be explained through our understanding.
Yes. In fact, I was reading this article a few days back that how, you know, after you study phenomena for a while,
mm-hmm.
you actually begin to think that yes, there is a rational explanation for
every
possible phenomena in the universe. But that article is saying that in fact that is a very false belief. That in fact what science studies is a phenomena that can be studied, which can be reduced to models which right. can easily be explained by
and replicated
physical models. So what filters through the sieve are those phenomena which happen so once in a while, which cannot get that easily duplicated. And because Swami himself says, you know, that most of the time he will not interfere with the laws of nature.
Mm.
And when he does, it is out of that feeling of grace and out of that love for that devotee. So it is not something that is going to happen with so much regular periodicity.
Right.
In most of the cases that I have seen, when people relate to me the experiences that they had with Bhagwan, so there is that initial period that when they come to Swami, it is like, you know, that bountiful grace. You know, Swami showers them with so much love, and practically anything that they ask, you know, Swami grants. It is like really the gates of heaven have opened, and it is like Swami is literally celebrating the renewal of that friendship. You know, it actually feels like that. But after a while, Swami expects them to graduate to where now their connection with Bhagwan or their love for Bhagwan is not a function of these kind of occurrences, miracles, etc. Right? In fact, if you listen to those people who had the privilege of serving Swami at a physical level and being very close to him at a physical level, you will notice that most of them say one thing, that no matter what kind of troubles they would undergo or their family people would undergo, they would never speak it out to Swami. You know, I was actually speaking to Mr. Chakravarti a couple of weeks back. He's presently the member secretary of the board of trustees, and he served Swami now from what, 44 decades. And I was trying to get from him, sir, is there like one, you know, personal, very sweet experience of yours that you can relate? And believe me, it was so very rare to find. And he explained, you know, that throughout my life and all that time that I spent with Swami, even if some illness befell his wife, even if it was serious, he would not tell Swami. In fact, Swami during darshan would go and inquire of her and ask her and do the necessary things. And we should remember that Mr. Chakravarti had such access to Bhagwan during several hours of the day. But he would treat Swami with that much respect, reverence, and never as someone that he had to get things out of, you know, that grace out of or something like that. He would always treat Swami with that kind of reverence. You know, so he never took advantage of that physical closeness to Bhagwan.
Right.
And because he always felt like, why should I trouble Swami with such small things when Swami is engaged in this, in like uplifting humanity itself. I have to be part of that instead of, you know, my imposing my small little troubles on him. So it like that is the kind of differences, gradations we see.
If you even look at the way Swami interacted with the children of his age when he was in school. You know, right. We hear all of those incidents where Swami would pull out objects from an empty bag and pluck fruits from a tamarind tree and all of that.
Yeah.
I mean, if we were to go back and follow the lives of those children who were with Swami,
yeah,
probably nothing much greater happened in their lives.
Correct.
They had the company of the Lord himself who could materialize all these objects, but I don't think any of them really would have in a miraculous way come out of their regular lives,
right,
of poverty or of their middle class lives.
Mm.
They would have gone through life in the regular sequence of events. So what you were saying, the idea that you cannot say that these events will cause grace to come on such and such a person, or this person has done these things so grace can come, you cannot study God's grace like that.
Mm-hmm.
And that is the problem with when you talk about scientifically understanding Swami or seeing Swami, and it just cannot work. But this idea of science and devotion actually having something in common, I mean, this is not new for the Indian thought, because even if you look at Ramanujam, because I happened to see that movie recently, the man who knew infinity, nobody in the West was ready to believe what he was saying, because he was saying that I'm getting all this from my my deity, I think Namagiri Ammal, he says, the deity in Namakkal, in the town of Namakkal. He says that, I don't do anything. The proofs come to me, and the theories come to me, and I don't know how to derive it myself.
Yeah.
But even today, I think the last set of notebooks which are found, even today they can't really prove how he has arrived at those theorems.
Correct.
I mean, it really, for a person like Ramanujam, has been brought up in that tradition, it was never a surprise for him that it was coming to him.
True.
But the rational West, the professors with whom he worked, could never understand where he was coming from.
Correct. Because even, just to elaborate on what you said, the results which he got, they are being understood now because there is so much development in the mathematical theory. But if you go back to those years of 1910, 1915, when all this was happening, he had no background, in fact, in order to generate
no
such
training.
Because now people are able to see to some extent, the connections. There's something called as a Mach theta functions, like which perhaps would have been highlighted in that movie. It's an absolute miracle that he wrote them at that time, because it came literally out of nowhere. Now people can make sense of that, but not at that time. So that as we said, there are certainly some things where they are like an opening to something which is beyond humanity. I think it is musicians who can see that the most.
Right.
Artists, musicians, they feel that, what they are able to achieve. Like one of our famous music composers, A.R. Rahman, he himself says this, that when he is bereft of inspiration, at that time what he does is he goes in and does namaz. In his house he has a shrine, he goes and does namaz. So he says that it is when I feel that connection to God, that is when I feel the music rising in my mind.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So that they are, I think, when you see artists or musicians, they are the people who can resonate with this the most. That there is something beyond our human realm of experience.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
I mean, that's what it is. There are two types. Talking about a musician, there's somebody who is giving a beautiful exposition in music. There might be two kinds of audience in listening to it. One, understanding the music, and probably when that arrogance is there, I understand this. This is what he is doing. Suppose Zakir Hussain is performing. Yeah, I know that this is the taal he's playing, and this is the combination he's playing. But there might be another person who also understands what Zakir Hussain is saying, but he's looking at him with awe.
Hmm.
Hey, he's playing this, Can you imagine some of our boys when they listen to recording of him? He says, hey, he's playing this style in combination with this, and he's mixing it up with that. They understand it, but they're looking at it with awe.
Correct.
But there might be another set of people who understand it and say, this is what he's doing. We know what he's doing.
Right.
But Swami is pushing us to that point where you understand, you read science. It's not that you don't undertake secular learning.
Yeah.
But the more you learn, the more you should be in awe of the way God has created this whole thing.
Because going back to that incident which you mentioned, so if you technically dissect it and look for the causal principles that were in play, you miss out actually the love and grace behind it.
Absolutely.
And which is what even atheists, they say that if there is one reason why they would want to become a theist, is because they say that when troubles afflict a person who is devoted to God, they say that they are better equipped to be equipoised, take it with calm, as opposed to somebody like so they feel envious that the person has an anchor to hold on to.
Literally. And I think that was the point where we literally stopped, where Swami was talking about, he started by talking about how we are moving away from devotion and away from the spiritual path. And then Swami was talking about was coming to the point where what really sadhana is. What is the meaning of that? What are we supposed to look at when we are trying to perform sadhana?
Right.
So I think we'll go to that clip, the next clip in that discourse.
What is sadhana?
Japamu, janamu, bhajana, yogamu, ityadi, satkarmala sadhana manipichukuntunda, kaadu kaadu.
Recitation of the name, meditation, devotional singing, yoga, do such good deeds constitute sadhana? Not at all.
Chedunu manchiga marchukotame nijamaina sadhana.
Transforming the bad into good is true sadhana.
Dukkamunu sukamuga marchukotame nijamaina sadhana.
Transforming the sorrow into happiness is true sadhana.
Dukkamuleka sukamule.
Without sorrow, there is no happiness.
Cheduleka manchi radu.
Without the bad, there comes no good.
Chedu manchi, sukhamu dukkhamu, nirantaram kudanu, ee rendintiki sangramam jarugutune untunnadi.
Good and bad, joy and sorrow, there is an eternal conflict between these pairs.
Kanuka, ee rendintini veru cheyatamu evari taramu kaadu.
So, it is not possible for anyone to separate these two things.
Kashta sukhamulu rendunum kalisiyundu bodhini vidade ayavari vasamu kaadu. Kashtam sukhamu pratyekamuga yendu chudabomu. Kashtamu palinchaneni sukhambatandru.
Sorrow and happiness, both are always together. It is impossible for anyone to separate them. We would not see happiness and sorrow as distinct entities. The fructification of hardship is verily happiness.
Kashtasukamulu rendu kudanu avinabhava sambandhamai anyonyasramamai jeevistu untai.
Both pleasure and pain exist as interrelated and inseparable. One is the source, the other is the culmination. One is the beginning, the other is the end. It is impossible for the beginning to exist without the end, and end to exist without the beginning.
కేవలం ఆధ్యాంతరహితుడు దైవత్వము తప్ప లోక సంబంధమైనటువంటి ప్రాకృతమైనటువంటి వస్తువులకు కాని విషయములకు కాని వ్యక్తులకు కాని ఇట్టి ఆనందం అనేటువంటిది కాని లేక ఆధ్యాంతరహితమైనటువంటిది కాని దీనికి లభ్యము కాదు.
ఓన్లీ గాడ్ ఈజ్ వితౌట్ అ బిగినింగ్ ఆర్ ఎండ్. ఎనీథింగ్ కన్సర్న్డ్ విత్ క్రియేషన్, ఆబ్జెక్ట్స్, మ్యాటర్స్, ఇండివిజువల్స్ ఆర్ హ్యాపీనెస్ cannot be beyond the beginning and end.
Dukkhamu aneetundi evaro manaku techi manam netti paina veyatam ledu.
Sorrow is not something that others fetch and place on our head.
Leka baadhalu chedda aneetundi kudanu ekkadi nunchi vachi mana tallo cheratam ledu.
Pain or bad does not come from elsewhere and reach our heads.
Chedda దుఃఖము ఇవి రెండు సహజంగానే ఆవిర్భవిస్తుంటాయి.
బోత్ బ్యాడ్ అండ్ సారో మానిఫెస్ట్ క్వైట్ నాచురలీ.
ఎంతటి పవిత్రమైనటువంటిది అయినప్పటికీ సాధన చేయకుండా ఇది ఒక విధమైనటువంటి నీచ స్థితికి దిగజారిపోతుంది.
హౌ ఎవర్ సీక్రెట్ సంథింగ్ మే బి, it slips to a detestable state without sadhana or spiritual effort.
ఎంత విలువైనది అయినప్పటికీ దాని యొక్క విలువ క్రమక్రమేణ కూడా క్షీణించిపోతుంది.
However priceless it may be, its value gradually diminishes.
సాధన చేతనే దాని విలువ అభివృద్ధి గాంచుతుంది.
Only through sadhana its value thrives.
ఒక చిన్న డైమండ్.
There is a small diamond.
అది మనకు చిక్కినది అనుకోండి.
Consider that we have found it.
కానీ దానికి విలువ చాలా తక్కువగా ఉంటుంటది.
But its value will be quite low.
దాని అనేక విధములైన సంస్కారములైన సాధనలు సరిపోయినప్పుడే, దాని కటింగ్స్ చేసినప్పుడే దాని విలువ పెరిగిపోతుంది.
Only when it's put through various refinement processes and make cuts on it, its value raises.
బంగారైనప్పటికీ మొట్టమొదట మట్టితో రాతితో కూడి ఉంటుంటది.
What we call gold exists as a mixture with sand and stone.
దాని సంస్కారమైనటువంటి సాధనలు కలిపినప్పుడే స్వచ్ఛమైనటువంటి అపరంజిగా మారి దానికి సరి అయిన విలువ లభిస్తుంది.
When it is put through this sadhana called refinement, it becomes pure and beautiful and thereby gets its true value.
కనుకనే సాధనము చేతనే అల్పత్వమైనటువంటి అధికత్వాన్ని పొందుతుంది.
So it is through sadhana or effort that the insignificant becomes significant.
అధోగతిలో ఉన్నటువంటిది ఉన్నత స్థాయికి చేరుతుంది.
From a lower state it reaches the higher state.
పుట్టిన తక్షణమే ఏ వ్యక్తి కూడా విద్యావంతుడు కాని పండితుడు కాని లేక గుణవంతుడు కాని కాడు.
No individual is a learned one, scholar or a person of character at the time of birth.
కమక్రమేణ తాను కొన్ని విధములైన సాధనలు సల్పటం చేతనే తాను గుణవంతుడిగాను విద్యావంతుడిగాను రూపొందగలుగుతున్నాడు.
Gradually through efforts one becomes a person of character or learning.
So that was the second clip in that in this course, and as we were telling, Swami starts talking about what is true sadhana, and a very beautiful definition, literally, you know, some of these words, the way Swami defines them is really classic, and this is one classic definition that Swami is giving for sadhana. Sadhana is nothing but transforming bad into good, sorrow into happiness. What a very beautiful and succinct way of putting it, isn't it?
At first blush, it is a very puzzling statement.
Right.
Like, what has spirituality got to do with transforming bad into good and sorrow into happiness? The second one especially. Like, transforming bad into good, maybe it is in the realm of our experience. But what does it mean to say, turn sorrow into happiness, and that being a spiritual practice? Very interesting.
And in fact, it's threefold. You know, that is probably the first stage which Swami is saying, that of transformation. The second thing which Swami says is about maintaining that state of goodness or whatever it is. The later he was telling about, even the best of things, if not maintained, they deteriorate. And the last thing which Swami says is, you know, you cannot stop at any state. You have to constantly keep adding value to whatever you have if you want to raise it from a mundane state to a supreme state. So literally Swami is talking of the three stages what sadhana is supposed to do to you when you embark on any spiritual practice. What are the three things which have to happen? And we can see that many people fall at different stages of this, isn't it? Because Swami would always talk about a concept called yoga brashtas. He would say that people who are very spiritually advanced, but who fail to maintain that state in which they are, fail to keep progressing. Because the moment you think that I've reached somewhere, you start looking down. You know, Swami would say that when you cease looking up and you start looking down, then your downward journey starts.
Swami would give the example of a silver or copper vessel.
Right.
He says, if you don't keep polishing it, after some time, patina forms. In fact, silver, it turns black.
Right.
So Swami would keep pointing out, it's very necessary to keep that practice up and not slacken at some time, at some point of time. So.
Right.
Because I remember once that he had given us these silver vessels, like right after, I think, one of the dashvas, I can't remember the year.
Okay.
But he gave us those silver bowls. And at that time I was very excited, oh, Swami has given. And then I stored it, inside an almirah, and I forgot all about it for a year. And then when I took it out again, I was so you know, devastated and I saw it as black in color. Then I remembered Swami's words that these are things that you need to keep polishing from time to time. Otherwise, they completely, they turn black and therefore lose their value altogether. So that is the very important thing.
That's a very classic example you're giving. Because every time there is this confusion when Swami gives you something, we would always have this. Because we know during dasha time or sometimes when Swami calls us for a PC session, you know, you would see all these goodies coming out and it will be randomly distributed. You don't know what you will get. You might get a bottle of perfume. You might get a shaving razor. Some of them will get Walkmans and cassette players. And after you receive it, always this confusion will be there. Should I use it? And, you know, make use of it. You know that if you start using, it's going to, you know, start losing its newness or whatever it is. Or it has been given by Swami. Should I preserve it so that, you know, generations later I can show that this was given by Swami? That confusion is always there, and invariably actually it's best to use it.
Yeah.
Because Swami would give it to be used. And many times you would see that when Swami gives watches, and I recall, I think 75th birthday when Swami gave watches, there will always be some of these boys who will say, you know what, 70th birthday also I got a watch, and later also I got a watch. I have never used any of them. Everything is preserved with me. But Swami will come around and you would see the primary school kids will be the first to unwrap the thing and wear it on their wrist. And that will make Swami so happy.
Yes.
He'll say, I've given you something and you're using it. I think that's a very profound thing that Swami was actually teaching us, that the many gifts which Swami has given, even the ability to think of God, the ability to be of service to another person, the ability to be good, as simple as that. If these are not put to use, actually, they don't get preserved, but they actually deteriorate over a period of time.
Exactly, they do. And that's why Swami himself would say several times that even the talent is a gift of God.
Right.
And you're meant to use those talents. And we've seen very clearly Swami himself saying that therefore the talents had to be used where? In the service of God himself.
Right.
Back in the service of God.
Right. Going back to what Swami said, that you know, sadhana is in essence transforming bad to good.
Yeah.
Swami says that, you know, what is meant by sadhana, it is not recitation of the name, meditation, the Navavida Bhakti and all of that. Swami says these are all methods used. This is not sadhana.
Yeah.
When you say sadhana, sadhana is meant to effect this change, good to bad, and I'm sorry, bad to good and sorrow to happiness. Right? It is meant to effect this change, and that is what is sadhana. But you might take any of these paths. You might take the chanting of the name, meditation and all of that. So that is only a process. It is not the sadhana itself.
Right.
I think that is something which many of us get muddled into. You know, when we talk of sadhana, we are always talking of the process or the tool rather than the process. It's the tool that we are talking about.
Correct.
And we don't measure whether that sadhana is doing what it's meant to do to us.
Yeah, because a very good point that we should not get caught up in the practice. I think this is something we talked about some time ago also, that
right.
the practice we undergo, that should be informed by wisdom.
Exactly.
That whether what we are undertaking is the right practice. So, Swami is also indicating that we must have the ultimate goal in mind and not miss the, you know, the wood for the trees,
right.
this week, right? So the larger picture is that this is what it is meant for turning, transforming bad into good and sorrow into happiness. But again, like I was just thinking that, you know, when there are several layers of meaning into that one sentence, when you say bad into good, the first layer is what we do understand is transforming our vices, right? And it's a very beautiful thing. I think it goes back to what we discussed in a few segments back, where Swami spoke about the different gradations of human being, like he would, the Danava Manava, and then had the animal, you know, the animal man, the demon man, then the animal man, and then the human man, and finally the divine man.
Right.
But what we saw was that essentially those qualities in different ratios or proportions are all present in each one of us at different points of time. Right. And so there is that thing of like moving across those different levels to finally that the divine man who seeks nothing but, you know, is always working selflessly for the service of mankind, right? But on the other hand, there is also the other thing that Swami says, you know, which also we have discussed, that Swami would say that ee srishtilo emi lopam aledu, mee drishtilone antundi. That is to say that creation by itself
has no flaws.
Yeah, is flawless. Right? And therefore, it is in your vision. You have to correct your vision, which Swami would, in several ways, he would explain. Like, one way Swami would say is, like, for example, if the entire world appears green to you,
mm-hmm.
right, that means you're watching it with green filters. You're not looking at the world in its true colors, like, right. reality. Like, it's colored completely with your perception.
Mm.
Right? And so, therefore, transforming bad into good in that sense is that there is nothing in the world to get transformed. And said differently, this was a very beautiful example. It made a great impact on me because I heard it in the first summer course that I attended in the year 2000. It took my breath away, the beauty of that example. Swami was speaking about, you know, that the parent who one day came home with a jigsaw puzzle as a gift for his kid, right? And so the puzzle was essentially to, the pieces were all, you know, of different portions of the globe.
Right.
And so the child had to put together the pieces in order to form the globe. So that was what the puzzle was. So he thought that, of course, this kid will not know the...
The kid occupied for quite some time.
Like
that must have been the idea.
I've got the evening off. I can relax. And the kid is busy with that. But as Swami says, 5 minutes later, the kid is back, right? With such an intricate jigsaw puzzle put together. So he was wondering, how did this kid put the world together so quickly, so to speak? And the kid says, and Swami puts it very nicely, that, you know, the kid showed the dad that if you reverse the entire, the pieces of the puzzle, what you have to do is put together a human body.
Mm-hmm.
And that the kid knew very well to do it. So Swami's message was that what you have to put together is yourself. And then the world will automatically write it.
Absolutely. No, somebody who made the jigsaw puzzle would have thought that if a kid happens to do it, let's give him an easier way out. And literally God has done the same thing, I think, you know, instead of trying to set the world right, set yourself right. But, you know, what even as you're saying that, that's exactly what Swami is saying. I mean, it didn't strike me earlier.
Yeah.
Because Swami is talking about turning sorrow into happiness.
Exactly. Yes.
And immediately after that, he goes into a short portion where he's actually asking us to accept sorrow and happiness equally. He's not telling that, you know, get rid of sorrow altogether, but the acceptance of sorrow and happiness as a part and parcel of life is what is progress. That's what Swami is saying. Which means, when he says, transform bad into good, it also means the thing that when you start seeing that bad also has its place, which Swami is going on to say in the next paragraph, that is when you actually see that even what appeared to you as bad before, now there is a certain context to it in the bigger scheme of things. You see that it has a place. It's not that you don't make efforts to transform the bad in you. That's not what I mean to say. But sometimes even what is bad actually has a reason to be there.
Correct. Yeah.
That is the understanding which you grow. And I mean, very true when Swami says that what you see in the world outside is actually a reflection of what is inside. You know, if you just look at it, most of the people we come across in life, you know, let's say that you're standing in a bus stand or you're standing in a railway station, there's somebody who is nasty, who's there, probably speaking loudly on the phone. Immediately we form a mental image of that person. Now, this person is irritating. I mean, if you look at it, here is a 50-year-old man, let's say. In 50 years of his life, you've spent 5 minutes with him and you've already judged him.
Correct.
And that's exactly what we do with everybody around us, even to people whom we have literally grown up with, let's say a sibling or something, still our judgment of that person is nothing but a judgment of that person.
Yeah.
It's not that person. So that is why I think Swami emphasizes that what you imagine the world to be is at the end of the day what you imagine the world to be, and it's not what the world is.
Exactly. In fact, what happens is, like, we may all be living on the same planet. Like, you and I are maybe living in the same ashram, for example. Forget the world. Like, living in the same ashram, we look at the ashram in entirely different ways.
Right.
Like, to give you another example, all of us here, like, we've seen Swami and we've had darshan, had occasion to speak to him. And the extraordinary thing that I've found out as I go to different places within this country itself, like, you go to Chennai, you go to Mumbai, and you go to Delhi, for example, and you talk to the devotees, you listen to what they have to say about Swami, and you will see that place wise also, what Parthi has an image about Bhagwan is entirely different from what a Bombay person speaks about Bhagwan, is different from what a Delhi person speaks about Bhagwan. I mean, you could almost generically see, you know, for a city, there is a different Swami. It is it's a phenomenon I've been observing, that the concept, what they look for, you know, in Swami, in Swami's life, in Swami's the experiences, etc., it varies so vastly from even place to place within India.
And absolutely. I think we can quite relate to that as speakers when you go and speak.
Yeah.
Many times we find this disconnect. You know, you are speaking of Swami from a mental image that you have, the kind of reverence that you have, the kind of freedom that you have, that also is there. You know, for you, Swami is more intimate. And sometimes devotee is a little appalled by the way you speak, the references that you make to Swami.
Yeah.
Because, as you're saying, we are coming from different places altogether, you know, in our approach to Swami.
Correct. And even, I've observed even as a student that Parthi and Vrindavan would be so entirely different. You know, what the way Swami himself would relate to people in Prashantilayam was so vastly different. Like when I was a student only here at Prashantilayam. I used to go to Vrindavan and used to watch, you know, open mouthed at the way the junior students, you know, those who are undergraduate, how they would speak to Swami, you know. It would be with so much, and Swami used to give that much love. And I remember once there was this one student, during one Trayi session, suddenly he got up and told Swami that, Swami, I have planted this one small new sapling in our garden. And he said, can I show it to you? I was like, what is going to happen now with something so small is troubling Swami. It was so beautiful to watch. Swami turned to him and said, okay, why don't you go and fetch it? And it was so interesting. Like, so he goes, you know, at the basically he was in charge of his, in the garden in the college campus.
Recall that incident. Actually, that boy had planted a bilwa plant.
Oh, it was a bilwa
plant. He was telling Swami that. Yeah. And he was himself surprised, as you're saying. Swami said, yeah, get it. And he ran to the hostel.
So he happily runs all the way and brings it, shows it to Swami. I remember Swami with so much attention, you know, he's looking at that. I recall in another instance like this, something that a student brought up. And Swami said, okay, go to the hostel and bring it. And when he came back, you know, Swami, out of so much love, he says, you must be tired, you know, that you have gone and come back. And Swami gave him water from his own tumbler. He said, drink from the same tumbler. So I used to watch all this and say, oh, like this is a different Swami altogether, you know. Right. So as I was saying, like, so when we may be living in the same place, we may be even physically close to each other, but the worlds that we inhabit are so vastly different. And this happens so much that we have each built our own cocoon of reality around us. And it may appear so very funny when we speak about it, but wars take place
to
over
protect
this
your
collision
identity,
of
right?
Realities. And the reason, like, why therefore Swami, you know, brings this up is to say that nothing is cast in stone, right? Not even our beliefs need to be cast in stone. Like as a great philosopher, Bertrand Russell, he was once asked, like, would you die for your beliefs? he said, no, I wouldn't. And the questioner was aghast. But he said, you know, they could be wrong. And this is a famous philosopher, a thinker whose entire, you know, day's work is essentially to get clarity on things. I mean, he's devoted to that task. But he has a humility, as you said, that, as Swami has said, rather, when you acquire knowledge, that is when you're confronted with the humility of there is so little that you know.
Very interesting you bring up Bertrand Russell, because Bertrand Russell is one of the people who tell Professor Hardy that you should have the humility to accept what Ramanujam is telling you. Your contemporaries living in Cambridge used to tell that, you know, you're not able to accept that somebody can have a God who can give them all these proofs.
Exactly.
It goes back to that. But the point, of course, going back to what Swami is telling, the idea of transforming bad into good, it's not necessarily transforming, changing everything. Yes, that does happen. But more than that, the perspective change that happens when you attempt to make bad into good.
Yeah.
Because that is something which we can't deny, that Swami always wanted us to transform ourselves, uproot the evil tendencies in us. That is something definitely which has to do. I mean, if you think that, oh, I have to accept all the bad in me and I have to live with that, that's not how it is.
That's not
the way. In the effort to do it, Swami says that you eventually realize that you're actually pure.
Yes.
That vices are not a part of your nature. That is the process which actually happens.
I remember, you know, there was this one, when I was part of the Hyderabad youth group, the Seva group, there's this one friend of mine who I had, right? And one of the occasions in which their group came to Prashanthi Nilayam, they had this opportunity of a interview with Bhagwan, an audience with Bhagwan. And I was told later, you know, that how Swami pinpointed this particular person, and he said, you got this very bad habit. And he was just looking at Swami, and Swami said, Swami, what he did was he named the bakery in Hyderabad, in front of which this particular, this boy, he would land there with his friends, you know, on a motorbike, and they would look at the girls who would, you know, come and go and all those things. And Swami said, I know what you are doing. You know, like, and one thing I've seen with Swami in such cases, even when he is admonishing, you don't feel judgment. I've seen this. Even when, I remember the times when he used to admonish me also, you would not feel that Swami is judging you. At times Swami would laugh along with you at your follies. Because Swami was so very clear that whatever vices, etc., as you have seen even in these discourses, they are a product of your lack of understanding. They have nothing to do with your being inherently a bad person. It all just comes down to a lack of understanding. And even when Swami would, sometimes he would say, you have made, he would say, don't call it a sin, call it a mistake. But again, he would not allow us to relax. He would say, when you commit the same mistake over and over again, that becomes a habit. And you got to watch out for that. So when Swami used to be very harsh on us in such cases, it would be to prod us out of that, and it would have us prod into, move us into a better understanding. And that would then result in, you know, better actions, etc. Like a person, I think the shortest way, as a person said, to transformation is simply awareness, like self-awareness, like watching the effect your actions have on others. What you say, what does it have on others? Having a feedback loop. You know, very simple technique, right, of bettering yourself. But what actually happens is you gain an understanding. Like when a person, say, who's given to anger or says nasty things, right, when most of the time our mind is closed to what the other person is feeling.
Absolutely.
But that day when we are ready to admit that, you know, taking that feedback of how, what effect it has on the opposite person, that immediately, you know, sets that feedback loop, and you stop, you temper it down, you attenuate, you know, so to speak, that nasty action of yours. So that is why Swami would, I remember, would be very loving, in fact, when he would point some things out like that. And that would create such a large space in which you could grow. You know, because he would not close it off. Sometimes, as teachers or as parents, sometimes we see that the way we admonish a child or anybody around us, it completely closes off any chance of growth of that person. It's like a judgment, like decided, cut them off. Absolutely. There's no growth happening there. But with Swami, it was so beautiful. He would never write off a person.
The interesting thing is, you know, when you're talking about, I think, the personal way in which Swami used to change. But many times if you see, I mean, we listen to Swami's discourses, Swami is quite hard when he comes down on some of these things. We've seen how Swami speaks about the society, Swami speaks about modern day students. And if you read some of the letters which Swami used to write to the students of Vrindavan in those days, Swami used to make it very clear that he's very disappointed with them. You know, you're doing this, how can you expect me to come and talk to you when you're not following what I say? It's very hard. I mean, I always used to think that Swami plays this hot and cold, you know. In the outside, when he's keeping the distance and when he's speaking in a discourse, I mean, Swami does not hide his emotions in that sense. He says that this is wrong, I'm upset about it, I'm very angry with it. You can see that emotion on him. And when, as students, when we receive it, I feel there are clearly two set of people. One set who's probably not moved by that. they don't relate to that anger of Swami. Mm. But there will always be one set which is completely moved and disturbed by that.
Mm.
That Swami is so upset. You know, I have upset Swami and we have done something which has upset Swami. And it is to that category the second treatment comes.
Right.
When in the individual level Swami comes and says, no, this is not, I mean, I'm not saying this to make you hate yourself or get very upset with yourself. Then Swami will start bringing the technique of handling with that. So it's always that first blow is hard.
Yeah.
And if you don't reel under that, then probably you're not ready for the second treatment.
Correct.
And the second treatment, as you said, is that's exactly how Swami would do. Swami would laugh along with you at your mistakes.
Mm.
And Swami would encourage you not to look at them as sins, but look at them as mistakes which can be corrected. And that is when Swami starts playing the role of a friend. You know, but to get into that zone, you have to be moved by Swami's anger and, you know, hurt.
Right.
That is the first step, I feel, you know, in many ways.
And the other aspect which Swami regularly addresses in so many discourses, and even in the set of discourses that we have discussed, so many times it has come up, the role of sorrow or the role of anxiety and misery. Because most of what we do as endeavors as human beings is essentially to move out of misery.
Right.
Of every kind. We look for comforts, we look for ways out of pain. And even like most of the present day like spiritual practices, etc., which stand as spiritual practices today, they also are essentially geared towards enjoying happiness at a human level.
Mm-hmm.
You know, how to beat stress themes like that, which are mostly addressed by the new age gurus of today, right? But if you look at Swami, as we have said earlier, like he puts it straight, you know, the report card as far as life is concerned, the Swami says that pleasure is simply an interval between two pains. Like that is so realistic, so straight and so stark.
Mm.
It's inescapable, right? It's actually we are fooling ourselves by being in pursuit of something elusive called happiness, because Swami says that happiness which the Vedas are talking about are not the happiness of the mind at all.
Mm.
It is something that goes beyond the mind. So we are actually pursuing essentially something that in the human realm is not possible, that continued happiness. In fact, Swami is saying so very clearly that, you know, even as he said, a sacred object slips down to a detestable state, and this is also true of a continually happy life.
Right.
Where you are never challenged, you are not pushed, you are always in your comfort zone. And this is true of almost any life situation. Mm-hmm. You don't grow unless you're tested.
Right.
Unless you're pushed against. Right. So that is the thing. So, and even as he's spoken about earlier, like sorrow is on the one hand, what shall I say, the balancing act of the universe.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And it sends us a very strong message. Like we were saying earlier that a person who has a sweet tooth.
Mm.
His ultimate dream is to be able to, you know, eat sweets throughout their lives. But we know that at the end of the road, what is waiting for him is diabetes.
Mm.
Right? So, likewise, any such indulgence, we've seen that the universe pushes back, and that itself is a, you know, it tells us that we've got some wrong concept of what life should be.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if our life were all about material pursuits, all about pursuing material happiness, etc., the universe is telling you may be wrong about that.
Mm.
And sorrow is that wake-up call, you know, that you may be pursuing the wrong thing, or said more positively, I'm missing something.
Right.
And which is what Swami keeps saying, that the more you indulge your senses, right, you're missing out on something that is beyond.
Right.
And sorrow is that, wake-up call. And we've seen also in another sense that sorrow is like a catalyst. We've seen like in the life of Lord Buddha himself, that he was born into luxury, right? And he was actually, as the legend goes,
protected from all of this.
His father made every effort, you know, to
insulate him from
any such sights of sorrow. But in the end, it is something inescapable. Mm. He does, in a very accidental fashion, he happens to see it, and that's what sets him thinking about the nature of life, and that's how we get the enlightened one.
Right. You know, talking about sorrow and running away from sorrow, that being our approach to life, is one beautiful analogy which Swami was giving. When Swami was talking about what it means to give up your animal nature. And Swami was giving this example in a discourse. He said, if you stand in one place and you have a bunch of leaves in your hand, and there is a goat which is standing far away. Seeing the bunch of leaves, the goat will come towards you, right? And in the place of the bunch of leaves, if you pick up a stick, the goat will move away from you.
Right.
So Swami said that is animal nature. To move towards something which is likable and to move away from something which can give pain. And Swami said that is the animal nature. But if that is continued into the human life, you try to shrug away from all sorrows and you try to move towards everything that can give you happiness. Swami saying that is animal life. You right. need to go beyond this incentive of happiness and the disincentive of sorrow.
Right.
And that is what has progressed into the human life. Very, very beautifully and graphically explained by Swami.
No better, I think, person who can illustrate such concepts.
So I think our time is up and we'll conclude with that. Thank you, dear listeners, for joining us. And really, one clip of Swami can set us off, and we've not really completed what Swami spoke there. And that's how beautiful Swami's discourses are always, and it's our pleasure to go through these in the course of this program. Thank you all for being participants in the form of listeners in this program of ours. We most humbly offer this at Swami's lotus feet. Do join us again next week at 7:30 for the continuation of this discourse. This is the discourse which Swami gave on the 1st of June 1991. And if you've noticed, we are playing discourse clips which have been retranslated. We have our brother Sunil who has given us the voiceover for the translation. In a short while from now, you'll be joined by Brother Bishu for the last segment of the day, the Vahini Satsang. But we'll join you again next week at 7:30 for the continuation of this discourse in the next episode of Shravanam, Mananam, Nididhyasanam.